This is the State of Things broadcasting from the Upstage Cabaret in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stachow. Practice what you preach is the well-known phrase that urges us to align our behavior with our beliefs, particularly if we dare to express those beliefs. But a glance at the headlines suggests that those who preach rigid adherence to moral commandments don't always follow them themselves. And while it's easy for us to judge the consistency of others, we are not so good at judging ourselves. At least that's the conclusion of Christian B. Miller. He's a professor of philosophy at Wake Forest University who focuses on moral psychology. His new book is called The Character Gap, How Good Are We? And he joins me now on The State of Things. Welcome. Good to have us here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Glad you're here with us. Tell us how you got interested in this the subject, The Character Gap.
Sure. So I've been interested in just philosophical questions in general for very long time. All the way back in high school, I was consumed by questions about the meaning of life. Why are we here? Does God exist? What's right and wrong? And what should I do with my life? What kind of person should I grow up to become? As I got older, I went to college and continued to think about these questions in graduate school. And one question that really jumped out at me was, how can I make myself a better person? I know I'm not perfect. I know I should try to become better. What steps can I take? And I started looking around for help in this matter. And one really interesting area of research that captivated me was psychological research. There's lots of studies that have revealed surprising things about who we are as people, good sides to our character and bad sides to our character. So I wanted to learn from that research to help it reveal flaws in my own life, and then ultimately to overcome those flaws.
So the first question you have to answer when you start asking that question is by what standard, right? Good, bad, by whose standard?
Right. And that's a big topic as well. I try to get around that question in my book by just pointing to examples I think we can all agree with. There are larger discussions. Where does morality come from? Is it set in place by higher being? If there is no higher being, does that mean that each human being can just invent right or wrong for themselves? So those are background considerations, really important ones. But rather than try and tackle all that in one short book, what I say is, look, there's a lot we can agree upon, regardless of where you're coming from. So, for example, we can agree that if someone collapses in a store from cardiac arrest, I should help that person. Turns out, in a particular example where this actually happened, most people didn't. What does that tell us about character? So I think we can look at examples of agreements to use in this discussion.
And that's really the centerpiece of your book, is the fact that we would like to think that we're pretty good. We would be the Good Samaritan, but in most cases, in many cases, we're not. And it's that gap between who we think we are and who we actually are on the ground.
That's correct. So what the psychological research taught me is that there's so many surprising facts about my character that I never realized before, and other people as well. Here's one of them. In an emergency, I would think I would come to the aid of someone who was in need. Turns out it's really complicated. So here are some studies to give some meat to that claim. In the 1960s, psychologists would take a participant, a volunteer for a study, bring them into a room, sit them down with a complete stranger. They would work on some paperwork. The person who had brought them into the room would then leave and go into the next room. The two people who were working in that room on the paperwork could then hear a crash. And then this person was screaming in pain, saying, my foot, my ankle, I've fallen, I need help, please help me. Well, if that was you, what would you do? Well, I think, obviously, I would help, right? I would do something. I would call out, pull out my phone, say, or run into the next room. Well, if the stranger who was with you did nothing, overwhelmingly, you would probably do nothing too. Only 7% of participants did anything to help when the stranger with them did nothing. That's stunning to me. And this is not just an artifact of the lab. It's not some, fake environment that's been created to get this kind of result. We see this in real life, too. So I alluded to an example of a store in 2011, Target, Black Friday. People are mobbing the store. This person, Walter Vance, has a heart attack, collapses on the ground. Lying there motionless, what would you do again? Well, I would expect people to help. I think I would like to say I would help too. In this real life version of this same topic now, people didn't help. They pretended like they saw nothing. I'm sure they saw it, but they pretended like they saw nothing. Some even walked over his body to continue their bargain hunting. It was only after quite a while that someone started to administer CPR to Walter Vance. But by then it was too late, and he died later that day.
So what does that tell us? Because what that suggests to me is that while the rules that we may all agree on that create some kind of social stability, we'll all agree on this, that those rules can be written in stone, that really what's written in our heart is far more elastic and far more relative to what the heck's going on around us.
Right. So what it tells me is that there is a character gap, hence the name of my book. So there's how I should be, and I think how we all should be. And then there's the reality of the struggles in our own person, of who we are. Now, it's funny you mentioned those rules, because those rules can actually be helpful tools to try and overcome that character gap. So let me give you an example of that. Different kind of research now. Switch from helping or not helping to cheating. So in certain situations, we can get people to cheat pretty reliably. Another disappointing fact. So you can get people, if they're told you'll be paid for each right answer you get on this 20-problem test. And, oh, by the way, you get to grade it yourself afterwards. And you get to shred your answer key. And you just tell me how many you got right. Is everyone going to report exactly the right number? Well, you hope so. That's the rule, right? Mm-hmm. The rule is to be honest, to tell the truth. Yeah. As a matter of fact, people didn't. So people whose tests did not allow any cheating, 7 correct answers. People whose tests allow them to cheat, to report whatever they wanted, 14 correct answers. Was that second group so much smarter? It could be, that's possible, but I think we know what's really going on.
Well, they were smart enough to get into the self-reporting group, so that, to me, that's a level of genius right there.
But now, that's true. Now, here's where the rules come in. Another version of it. This is so cool, I had to mention it. Another version of this study, where first you're asked, try to remember as many of the 10 commandments as you can. Here's the rules. Then you take the test, and you're given an opportunity to cheat or not. Cheating disappears completely. The average score in that group was back down to 7. So rules, and it's not specific to the 10 commandments, it's just the point about moral rules in general, when they serve as a helpful reminder of how we should behave, can curb some of our less than admirable tendencies.
Not just the rules, but also the research that you cite in your book that shows if we read about admirable people or admirable characteristics, that kind of priming does change your behavior.
That's right. So this has to do with the idea of admiration and emulation. So when we see people who we admire, say Abraham Lincoln, or Harriet Tubman, one person who I've learned about in my research, who I deeply admire, is his last name is Socha. I never heard of him before, but he protected 20 Jews in the sewers of a Polish town for over a year during World War II. Every day would crawl through the sewer pipes. You know, imagine that, the smell and the stink and everything, to bring food to these 20 Jews he was harboring. That, to me, is a moral hero. When I see someone like that, I want to become more like that. I know I can't do exactly what he did, but is there a way to translate what he's done into my own life? And so I not only admire him, but I want to emulate him, become more like him. I think that's a powerful tendency most of us have.
And there's research that suggests that if I were to read about that person and then go into a test where my moral character there was some other test of my character, I'm more likely to perform up to the standard.
That's right. So it can make a difference, not just in what we hope to do, but what we actually do, the kind of person we are. It can reshape our character to try and close that character gap between how we are.
So what that suggests to me is that character is really a matter of conditioning, because that's what you're describing, a way of conditioning the mind. And so if you go to a rigid school in a place where they're re-emphasizing this over and over and over again, perhaps there's a likelihood that you'll demonstrate more character when the going gets tough, because you've rehearsed it. You've conditioned yourself to be that being.
Right.
Isn't that what's happening here?
So I would put it in terms of habituation, habits, traits, making yourself into a kind of person through practice. Sometimes conditioning could make it sound like it's out of our control or it's just automatic. I tend to think of it as, no, we have some control over this. What kind of person I want to become? I can set myself on a certain path, but you can't do it overnight. I can't become a virtuous person. I can't become an honest person just by snapping my fingers. It's a slow, gradual process. It's kind of expertise. Just like you can't become a chess master overnight. You can't become a virtuous person overnight. Unfortunately, I wish we could. It would be great. The world would be a much better place. But it doesn't work that way.
But that habituation, conditioning, if you want to call it that, that priming yourself and reiterating the value over and over and then seeing those admirable so that you have examples of it that are kind of outside of your own mind, that seems to me to require a level of socialization. In other words, we have to be wired to care what other people think in order for any of this to take hold.
That's true. So we have to care what other people think. We also have to care about doing right and wrong. So psychopaths aren't going to be very good cases to talk about right here. So we have to have some kind of emotional preparation to go down this path. I think it's not just what other people think, because if it was just a matter of what other people think, then I might be doing it for the wrong reasons. So I want to help people if I'm a virtuous person because they need help, not because I'm worried about what my friends or my peers or what the media is going to say about me. If that's what's really going on in my mind, then it's about me.
I'm going to hold your feet to the fire on this one, because those people who step over the body, right, have told themselves at some point in their lives, I'm the person, if I ever saw that happen, I would certainly help that person. Mm-hmm. And the people who walked over that body, probably me, would have read about that story had they not been there and been appalled at all those people, and yet they were the ones who walked over, which is to say that in the absence of this sense of what other people are thinking, because And my assumption here is if I'm watching other people walk over them, nobody's going to think ill of me. And therefore, whatever great character I brought into this, it's the right thing to do, gets lost in the, well, nobody else seems to care.
Right, that's right. So you're right. So I should have been a little bit more careful. Role models make a big difference. So if in groups, if no one's helping, it's very unlikely I'm going to help. We need that courageous person to take the first step, to break out of the pattern or the trend that other people are following. And if that person takes that first step, others are very much likely to follow. Again, though, the question is, why would I, having seen that role model, help as well? Is it because I want to follow the herd here? I'm going to do what everyone else is doing? Or is it because that role model has helped me to see something that I was missing? That there's a stranger in need, and that person's suffering matters more than anything else in that situation. That's what the role model accomplishes, I say amen.
Now, what do you see happening? Because if we think about the way media functions today, and I'll compare that to just in my own lifetime, you know, go back to three networks, everybody, you know, was sort of, we all saw the same movies, we were all watching the same TV shows, reading, you know, roughly the same stories in the paper. That's changed a lot now. And so our role models and our sense of what's important, what other people are thinking, and what builds character may be more diffuse now.
That's, I think, correct. So where does that take us? Well, maybe there are still some common role models that we all share that we can point to. And then we also have to appreciate the fact that there are going to be different role models in different traditions. So we have to appreciate the diversity of religions. We have to appreciate the diversity of ethical traditions and look to the role models in those different traditions, for sure. But I would at least hold out hope that there are some exemplars that transcends a lot of differences. No exemplar is perfect. Everyone has weaknesses. On the cover of my book is Gandhi. He had some moral flaws. Abraham Lincoln had moral flaws. Martin Luther King had moral flaws. But these are people who I think we can all agree were exemplars of good character, who in many respects we can strive to emulate. Yeah,
but do you think the character is an absolute thing, in that it is universal among humans, that there's some core kind of good character that you can point to?
I think it's something that people throughout different traditions, throughout different cultures, and throughout time largely agree upon as important. So let's make that a little bit more concrete. Honesty. It's hard to find a tradition throughout time that doesn't care about honesty. Now, maybe they don't define it exactly the same way. Maybe there's some differences about whether lying in this particular case is okay or not. But by and large, cultures agree that honesty is important. I think we can then multiply the examples from there. So we can take an example of kindness or compassion. We can then generate a list of widely held, widely accepted virtues, admirable character traits.
But then, when it comes down to parsing them and saying, well, is this that or not? I mean, if you think about, let's take the advertising industry, for example. Mm-hmm. If we all agree that honesty is important, you know, there's ways in which the truth has to be manipulated. And my knowledge of how your perception works has to be deliberately manipulated to buy something that perhaps you may not need. And if that's a permissible, you know, your neighbor goes to church and they're in that business and they're an honest person, don't we have a kind of sliding scale of what we mean when we say honest?
Sure. So I think honesty could be compatible with certain kinds of lying. So there's an absolutist view, which means lying is never acceptable. I'm not so sure I want to go that far. I think I can imagine cases where lying is okay. Morality lets me do that. So if someone is in Nazi Germany, knocks on the door and says, do you have any Jews in your basement? And I do, and I'm hiding them down there. That's okay for me to lie. I think that's not just okay, it's probably the right thing to do. However, other situations like you're talking about here, where we're talking about advertising manipulating us in a deceptive manner in order to buy certain products, that's, I think, crosses the line. That would not be an example of acceptable honesty.
You're talking about a multi-billion-dollar industry, pal.
Oh, sure.
Watch your step. Well, I'm also thinking of revenge cultures, too, where it's considered virtuous to take revenge had you a member of your family be killed. It is your responsibility to kill a member of another family. And if you didn't, you'd be dishonored. And that's taken very seriously in some cultures. And so, again, I do think that there are certainly relative values that change from place to place, but that are considered virtues within those cultures that we may not embrace at all.
Sure. And certainly cultures have different values and they accept different things that we may not accept. That's true. So then this comes back to the very beginning of our discussion. Is there an objective answer? Is it ultimately just a matter of cultural relativity, cultural differences, or is there a deeper underlying morality behind cultural differences? My own view, just to mm-hmm. put it out there, is that there is an objective morality. There is one set of ways we should live our lives, one set way we should live our lives. Now, that's going to look very different depending on what our lives involve. So being a sewer worker in a Polish town during World War II might involve being honest and courageous in a very different way than being a professor at Wake Forest University today involves. Nevertheless, certain things like torturing others for fun, that's wrong, period, objectively speaking. Something like letting that poor person in the Target store on Black Friday die without coming to his assistance at all, not doing anything, that's wrong, objectively speaking. Even if other people might disagree with me, I'm going to put my foot down on that.
Great stuff. Christian B. Miller is a professor of philosophy at Wake Forest University, and his new book is called The Character Gap, How Good Are We? Thank you so much for joining us. You can find links to his book at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we preview a Greensboro-based magazine that features the narratives of LGBTQ youth. It's called I Don't Do Boxes. But first, here's the music of Ann Claire Niver, who joined us today on The State of Things.
In the land of Siam, I am not okay. In the land of Siam, I am not okay. In the land of Siam, in the land of Siam, in the land of Siam, in the land of Siam. Don't know where I'm going. Don't know where I've been. The sun above keeps